Welcome to Take It From Us with host Kent Johns. Real people, real voices, real lives, discussing mental health, addiction, and disability in the community. Your weekly window to the real world. Welcome to Take It From Us.
Well, back in 2015, 18-year-old Jake Bailey gave what was to become a very famous speech from his wheelchair at Christchurch Boys High School's prize giving. Only 1 week earlier, as he was preparing to deliver his head monitor address, he was diagnosed with a very aggressive cancer, one that would take his life in only a matter of weeks if left untreated. The speech was powerful, it was humble, it was gracious. It's now been viewed tens of millions of times by people all around the world. 10 years on, and Jake is fit and healthy. He's now a full-time public speaker, educator and author. And his second book, The Comeback Code, has just been released. In our conversation with him, we talk about his cancer battle, teaching resilience to students, traveling the world to deliver his messages, and studying positive psychology. His is an uplifting and inspiring story. Here is Jake Bailey on Take It From Us. Jake Bailey, welcome to Take It From Us.
Privileged to be here, Kent. Yeah, thanks for the opportunity.
Jake, it's really lovely to have you on our program. How are you doing these days?
Yeah, I'm doing really, really well. I'm sort of fit, I'm healthy, I'm happy, and I don't know. I'm not sure whether it's a reflection of sort of the life experiences which I've had over the past 10 years or whether it's something which most people sort of naturally gravitate towards over the course of their lifetime. But for me, that seems to be the main measure of how, you know, good things are and how well I'm doing. And as long as I can tick those boxes, then yeah, I'm great.
We'll get to the new book, Comeback Code. I'm really interested as to who you've written this book for, how we would benefit from taking on some of your learnings. But I just thought I'd ask if you to reflect over the last 10 years since A, that cancer diagnosis, but then also the speech that you gave, which had such a profound effect on people. How have you changed as a young man in that time?
Well, it's a big question. It's a great question. I guess it's the funny thing about, I guess, separating that, you know, the pre-cancer and post-cancer change, or even the journey in terms of, you know, the study and learning and work that I've undertaken over the course of the last 10 years, it's quite hard to sort of isolate that from the natural progression and growth and change that you go through from being, you know, 17 to 27, which, you know, aside from that developmental phase, I guess being, you know, 7 to 17 is probably the time and stage of life where you change the most, perhaps, right? I mean, 17 years old, you're very much still a kid at the end of the day, as much as I never felt like one at that time, and I don't think any of us do at that age. I look back now, or I see my siblings who are 10 years younger than I am, and sort of think, you know, wow, you're so early on in things, right? You're so young. And then, yeah, 10 years later, 27 now, and sort of being a bit more established, being out in the world and sort of, yeah, moving forward in that way, there's a lot of that natural growth and change and progression which you go through as well. So I guess how do I reflect on that change? Well, I think, you know, post cancer, and this probably isn't so much of a change over the last 10 years. I think this was just a real cancer-related change. I am a happier person. I am a more grateful person. I think I enjoy my life a lot more after the cancer than I did beforehand. And, you know, I think a lot of that came down to some of the resilience and some of those skills and tools around resilience, which I learned from going through that period of challenge and adversity. And I think, you know, probably that contrast from pre to post cancer was so stark simply because of the time at life which had occurred. You know, in the months prior to my cancer diagnosis, I'd been, you know, the sort of prototypical angsty, anxious teen worrying about, you know, relationships and friendships and university or what I was going to do after school or sports results or exam results or fallouts with mates or, you know, what party I hadn't been invited to that weekend and all of these things which are a really normal, average part of life. I think post cancer, pretty quickly, I guess I was better equipped to deal with some of these challenges going through that period of significant adversity and upheaval. The cancer and the treatment had taught me some, I guess, a bit of a framework through which to face some of these other challenges which I'd previously been bogged down with. And so I think after the cancer, I was a lot, it brought a lot more levity to life simply because of that. And then I guess in the change since then, and how else I look back on it, like I say, I'm happier now than I've ever been. I'm healthier now than I've ever been. I'm fitter than I've pretty much ever been. I look back on the last 10 years and I feel incredibly grateful to be where I'm at now and really, really, really satisfied with how the last 10 years have gone and feel very, very, very lucky, I suppose, to even have the ability to look back on the past 10 years since the cancer and still to, to still be here.
Yeah, and what changes to your life did you have to contemplate making or were you forced to make to ensure that you are as healthy and you are as vibrant as you are 10 years down the track?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you are 17 or 18, and I was 18 when I was diagnosed, just sort of freshly 18, and 18 when I was announced in remission as well. I had 3 months of treatment, which is, I was incredibly fortunate. That's a relatively sort of short period of treatment. But being an 18-year-old, health was not, that time of life, health is a class which you're forced to attend at school. Health is not a principle which is front of mind, right? So I treated myself and my body pretty much in line with how I think most teenagers tend to. I didn't take particularly good care of myself for the simple reason that I was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, as all young men are at that age and stage of life, I think. So I think, again, it's sort of hard to disentangle what is a natural progression over the course of the last 10 years from what maybe has been spurred or sparked by the cancer and those health challenges, and then I suppose subsequently the gratitude which I now have for my good health and for my body. But I do a lot of things differently now than I did back then, that's for sure. I exercise a lot more, but it was back then I just didn't exercise. I used to play a bit of social football, and I used to sort of just completely refuse to do the warm-up jog around the pitch at the start of the match sort of thing, right? Like I did not exercise. I was vehemently opposed to exercise. Whereas now, I do a lot of endurance sport and exercise and fitness and health is a big part of life for me and a big part of what I guess contributes to my well-being and happiness. I've found I eat a lot better than I used to back then. I sleep and rest a lot more. I'm a lot more focused on taking care of myself than I was previously. And again, like I said, I'm not sure of how much of that is as a consequence of the cancer and those health challenges and how much of that is just a natural kind of growth and development that we all go through of from our teenage years to our late 20s. But either way, I think my body and my health, including my mental health, is in a way better space now than it ever was back then, because I prioritise and take care of it in a way which I never have before, really.
How were you able to progress to being able to complete ultra marathons, and what was the drive behind that?
How was I able to progress to be able to do that? By starting out really sucking at running, and I still suck at running now, but the thing is I can just do it for increasingly longer periods of time, right? Like this is something which I talk to students about when I go speak at schools. When I was at school, and as I say, I avoided exercise. The reason I avoided exercise is because I sucked at it so much, right? Like I would write myself sick notes to get out of school sports days. I would feign sort of growing pains and injuries to avoid having to do PE classes. I was about as unresilient as you could possibly get in the face of some of these challenges related to fitness and exercise when I was a teenager. And I guess the advice that I give to other young people who might find themselves in a similar position to that when I go speak at schools now, and it's tongue-in-cheek, of course, but it actually is, it is entirely true, which is that whilst I never found a sport which I didn't suck at, I found that with endurance sport, you don't actually have to be good at anything. You just have to be able to do it for a really long time. And like I say, I still suck at running. It's just that now I can run for 10 hours without stopping, which makes me sort of like half okay in the world of endurance sport. So how did I get up to doing that? By starting out sucking and then just still sucking, but continuing to be able to do it for longer and longer periods of time and building up to it, I guess. And
basically don't suck as bad.
Yeah. Well, I think I still suck as bad, but like I say, I mean, I can do it for longer than I've ever been able to do it before. And so that sort of in the world of endurance sport anyway, makes you like half all right, which is quite cool. So if you suck at sport, endurance sport's the sport for you.
I was just astonished at anyone like yourself who's able to complete running distances of that magnitude because of the mental battle. And you talk about not necessarily needing to be good, but that's a real practice kind of skill in itself, is having that mental fortitude not to give in. I'm wondering whether for you, did you lean into that cancer journey and think, well, running is, it ain't nothing compared to what I've been through. I can do this because I've survived probably the hardest fight of my life. Is that kind of how you leaned into it?
Yeah, an interesting question. And there's probably sort of three prongs to that. One, that's something which my mum has talked about previously with my cancer experience. You know, when I was going through treatment and when I was going through hospital, mum got into running and exercise, which is something which she'd never really been into prior to that, or at least not for a long time. And it was sort of a release for her in terms of stress and a support for her mental health and well-being when I was in hospital. And she used to talk about how for her that was one of the things which enabled her to keep on going, was, I guess, putting it into making it relative to what I was going through in terms of treatment, which is, yeah, very, very touching. And for me, it's not something which I do or have ever done. I suppose there's kind of one way in which that does show through, which is the sort of the second prong that I was going to touch on. And that is that, I guess, for me, endurance sport, or the pathway that I've found to endurance sport, was led by the cancer journey itself. And I think the reason I say that is because I came away from the cancer experience and the experience of treatment with an understanding of the fact that, one, my body was capable of enduring a hell of a lot more than I ever thought it was possible for it to be able to do. And that, two, the key to unlocking that was in the sort of top couple of inches more than anything else, right? Like, there are a lot of times going through treatment where I thought, you know, fuck, there's just no way I can continue to withstand and endure this. And without fault, I was always able to, you know, whether it was, you know, against my will or not, the body just sort of keeps on chugging along without any sort of consideration of how the top part is going. If you try and fight against that or push against that, it doesn't work. But if you can use your mind to, I guess, continue pushing forward, then it helps. So I think endurance sport for me has probably been the only outlet that I've ever found which allows me to experience just how much the body can withstand and endure, and where the mind does come into play, like you say, in terms of getting through and getting out the other side. And then the third and final thing which I was going to touch on in relation to that is that, you know, you lead into that question was around, I don't know how people can, you know, build up to or get towards and getting to those distances, right, and running rather than further and further races. And I completely get that. When I run, you know, ultra marathons or I do endurance sport, we're talking about distances of, you know, sort of 60 to 70 Ks, which in the world of ultra marathon running is like the baby side of things, right? Like, there are many, many people out there doing, you know, milers, which is a very common event, isn't 100 miles, 160 Ks, or people doing multi-hundred kilometre races. For me to be out doing, you know, 60 or 70 Ks is, you know, it's a training day for them, right? So in terms of how you actually get to doing that, the reason that I wanted to touch on that is because it really speaks to how you get through adversity or how you become resilient in life anyway. And the answer is that it's all relative. Like you say, you know, mentally, how are you able to get through a 60K run? Well, the answer is because I've spent a lot of time out there going for runs of, you know, significant distances or comparable distances. And so I know that I can always do a little bit more than I've done previously. The 60K race that I did recently, I knew that I could get through it because I'd done a 50K training run in the lead up to it. And I knew that I could get through that 50K training run because I'd done a 45K training run in the block prior to that, right? And so it's all about creating these building stones or stepping stones, which allow you to continue to take on, you know, bigger and greater and more significant challenges, right? I think everyone gets that in life. It doesn't have to be massive distances. I know when I first started out running, I knew that I could do sort of, you know, 2.5 Ks because I'd done 2 Ks the week prior. It's the same thing. The reason I talk about this is not because I'm trying to give, you know, exercise and training advice for running. It's that, as I say, this is exactly how we get through adversity in life and how we learn to be resilient. We know that we can get through, you know, this divorce because we've got through being made redundant before. Or we know that we can get through this loss of a loved one because we've got through a divorce before, right? And so when it comes to facing adversity and challenge in life, it's incredibly important for people to willingly, consciously, actively take on challenge and face adversity front on so that they can continue to, I guess, create and build these stepping stones of resilience. You have to go out there, you have to undertake challenges so that you've got, I guess, those first couple of steps in place, particularly for our young people, so that when they start to face that, you know, redundancy or divorce or loss of loved one, they've hopefully got something prior which they can look back on and say, you know, hey, I got through that, you know, failed exam or missing out on going to university when I wanted to, or, you know, failing to make the winning kick in that sports match final that I was in, or that fallout with a friend. You know, we need to be facing and learning these skills of resilience through manageable, controllable adversity, normal, average, everyday adversity throughout life.
Everyday stress, hormetic stress. As the saying goes, whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And you're so right. Our bodies and our brains, we are craving stressful environments at just the right dose so that we go even beyond resilience and we get to now what's called anti-fragility, where we are stronger for the experience. The problem is, though, Jake, as you would be well aware, that can tip over into chronic stress, which leaves us in fight or flight mode for way too long. And you look around at people who are just burnt out, tired, knackered. I worry about younger people these days and how much stress and stuff they are taking on. So how do you get that message to those people about getting the balance right? Stress is our friend, but too much of us is actually not good, and we've got to come up with ways to cope with what life's throwing at us.
Yeah, I think that, and all of what you've said is correct, but I think that it comes down to what stresses we are taking on and how we are trying to push and extend ourselves, right? So if in your life, the way in which you are trying to push and develop your sense of resilience is to undertake a challenge through something like trying to learn a second language or picking up an instrument later in life and trying to get better at it, or, you know, getting into running or the gym or pushing yourself out of your comfort zone and going out to meet people, expanding your social circles. All of these things are, I guess, productive, helpful, useful examples of stresses which we can willingly undertake and sort of voluntarily put ourselves under, which go towards creating, as you say, there's anti-fragility and a sense of being better prepared to go out into the world. You undertake these challenges willingly. You come away with a sense of what is called self-efficacy, your ability to sort of back yourself to be able to get through things because you know you've got through X, Y, or Z beforehand. So those are all productive uses. When it comes to some of the other examples, which is maybe sort of alluded to there as well, whether it's, you know, picking up more and more stress at work, increasing that workload, whether it is, I don't know, maintaining or existing in a relationship which isn't happy for a prolonged period without doing anything about it, whether it is, you know, surrounding yourself with situations or people or environments which are not conducive to good mental health and well-being, simply because you think that to be able to outlast that or to endure that makes you a better, stronger person, is generally going to be a falsehood, right? We need to be really selective about how we, I guess, choose to expose ourselves to these stressful environments. And at the end of the day, I don't think it's necessarily all that hard for people to work out what is good and what is not. Like, I think it's relatively intuitive. I talk to a lot of schools and I work with a lot of parents and communities through that. And I guess increasingly it's extraordinary to hear from schools and even to hear sometimes from parents about how they perceive some of the stresses and stress factors in their young people's lives and the inappropriate ways in which they respond to that. And, you know, some really good examples are things like school camps. A lot of schools that I speak at now, particularly intermediate schools, are saying, you know, school camps are becoming increasingly non-viable because parents will pick up the phone the week before school camp and say, you know, Timmy doesn't want to go on school camp. It's making him upset. It's making him anxious. I'm not going to make him do that if he doesn't want to, right? This one rings a bell for me because it's precisely the same experience that I remember having growing up. I never wanted to go on a school camp. I fucking hated school camps because they were very, very anxiety-inducing, upsetting, distressing. They made me nervous. I'd lose sleep in the lead-up to them. And guess what? I said the same things to my parents as these kids are saying to their parents today. But my parents said, no, it's good for you. You'll go to it anyway. And I'm grateful that they did because that is one of those normal, healthy stresses which creates normal, unhealthy emotions and reactions, which can be being, you know, nervous or anxious or upset. And then to be able to go through that and overcome that leaves you with, as a young person particularly, the sense of self-belief, self-efficacy, your ability to overcome and get through and back yourself to overcome these challenges. The same thing goes for, you know, a plethora of examples, particularly when it comes to young people. My point is that I think for most of us, we can figure out what are good situations to place ourselves into to create stress, or to place our kids into to create stress. Maybe there's a little bit of a shift away from that. Maybe increasingly parents are losing touch with what a, you know, a normal human reaction might be to a normal human stressor like school camp. But I think by and large, the majority of people can sort of process that for themselves.
You gave a very eloquent answer a few minutes ago when I asked you about the where you are now compared to 10 years ago, and you described probably that life would be look different for you regardless because of that growth phase. Mm. As the prefrontal cortex develops and young men mature between sort of 18 to 28. But you do talk a lot to young students, and you would know as well as me that a lot has changed in the last 10 to 15 years about the way that young people process information and deal with emotions. When you look at particularly digital technology and this really big role that it's played, what are you noticing about 16 to 18 year olds and how they cope as opposed to your generation, which albeit is only 10 years older?
Yeah, so and it's hard to sort of generalize. When I work with groups of young people, you know, and particularly given that my role is not within, I guess, clinical psychology, I don't have a lot of opportunity or capacity to engage with young people one-on-one. And so it's hard to, I guess, characterize across a you know, a wide group of young people, given that I haven't worked with them individually. It's hard to draw links, I guess, between them. Definitely, I guess in that situation, it's quite easy to just sort of zoom back and refer to the research, the information, the statistics. And what we're seeing is that young people now are more anxious and more stressed than they have ever been before. In terms of causes for that, you know, you talked about digital technology and information there. That definitely seems to be a contributing factor. And, you know, it's not an area which is a sort of my expertise, but I think that the Bible in this space right now, at least, is the book, The Anxious Generation by an author called Jonathan Haidt, which
I read it.
It's fantastic. I couldn't recommend that book more highly. Any sort of opinions or perspective which I have on this would just be his regurgitated less eloquently than
well, you know what, Jake? The reason why his book is so great and why he's such an eloquent talker to listen to on podcasts or to watch TED Talks or whatever, Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T, is because he actually offers solutions. He's empathetic. He understands the problem. He's researched the problem, but he also offers up solutions. And one of those is to one of your points, maybe about parenting, and that so many of us now are helicopter parents and we're struggling just to allow our children to go and scrape their knees and fall out of trees to gain the knowledge of risk management and risk adversity, which is part of the maturing brain.
Yeah, so and you raise a couple of good points there. One, when it comes to the parenting side of things, I'm always very clear up front that as a, you know, 27-year-old with precisely zero children, I'm in no position to give parenting advice, right? And I actually have a little sympathy for parents because I think that there is increasingly societal messaging which suggests that if you allow your young people to go through, you know, challenge or adversity or stress, and you don't intervene to prevent that when you have the capacity to do so, that you're somehow a negligent or deficient parent, which is just not the situation at all. But the second part of that is, and it's really interesting that you touched on this as well just now, I'm 27, as I just said. I think I kind of straddle both sides of the bull rush and tree climbing generation and then the post bull rush tree climbing ban generation, right? I was about 7 years old when all of these things sort of fell out of vogue and we were suddenly told we had to play touch bull rush and there was no tree climbing. And I think that by and large, and maybe this is a mischaracterization, but I think that by and large, as a society, we have accepted now what you've just said, which is that when we deprive our young people of the opportunity to experience physical risk and danger in a relatively safe, normal, controlled environment, like tree climbing, like playing bull rush, like being on the monkey bars at school, that doesn't keep them safe for the rest of their lives. It just stunts their ability to develop and grow these skills around risk assessment and good decision making whilst they are in that controlled environment. It means that because they don't learn it then, they now have to learn it at a party when they're drinking or when they're experimenting with drugs for the first time or when they're driving a car and speeding, right? We don't deprive them of risk for the rest of their life. We just leave them in a position where they have to go out and learn these skills on the fly. I think that by and large, people accept that. I guess the irony is that I suspect that we're at risk now of doing the same thing all over again, but with psychological risk, right? We accept that if we deprive them of physical risk, it's worse for them later on in life. And yet we're still willing to increasingly take them out of school camp, or we're willing to march down to the school office when they get in trouble and face the consequences of their own actions because we don't like that. Or we'll intervene and talk to their coach if they don't make the team that week, or we'll talk to the teacher about getting them to resit an assignment which they failed. And, you know, probably for 90% of people, this will be something which they know goes on. It's probably not something which the majority of people listening to this will undertake. I'm not accusing, you know, the vast majority of parents of being like this. But believe me, you know, if it sounds unbelievable or unfamiliar to you, the schools that I work with are dealing with this on a day-to-day basis. And as I say, I think, you know, 10, 15 years from now, we're going to be looking back and seeing these increasingly anxious, poorly equipped young people. And we're going to be asking ourselves, why did we deprive them of the opportunity to learn these skills when they were in a relatively safe environment of school? You know, schools are life's training ground for literacy, numeracy, and for everything else, for interpersonal skills, for risk management, for resilience as well.
You have studied positive psychology extensively. Do you fall prey to negative self-talk?
Yeah, look, I think to fall prey to negative self-talk is, first of all, it's interesting how you frame it. I think that, you know, falling prey to it, I think negative self-talk is kind of part of how we work and operate as people, right? And it's a relatively kind of cliched way to view it, I suppose, but it's that yin and yang type situation, right? I don't think that you can have necessarily a great deal of balance within yourself if you don't have those opposing sides of, you know, a sense of what you're good at and a sense of maybe that negative self-talk as well. Do I have that within me? Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And I think that where that becomes unhealthy is where people are incapable of being able to sufficiently manage that or to control it or to just sort of switch it off. But I don't think that there's anything inherently wrong, and people can feel free to sort of challenge me on this as well, but I don't think there's necessarily anything inherently wrong with having that within you. I think it's about your ability to control it more than anything. I feel relatively well equipped to be able to control that the majority of the time.
Yeah, you're probably right there to kind of pull me up on the phrasing of the question as in falling prey to it, because it's there, it's an evolutionary adaptation. That negative self-talk or the saboteur is there to protect us. But what we also know is that for so many of us, that voice is loud and it's rampant and it can be crippling. Do you still run into a loud, crippling self-talk that can really knock you around, or have you now got coping strategies to manage it?
Yeah, I don't run into that, no. And I don't think that I necessarily have particularly battled with that much throughout life. There's definitely been phases or times when I've gone through significant challenges around that. And I think that most people have experienced that, you know, during those low points or during those tough times, that self-doubt or inner critic is louder and tends to sort of come out more. In terms of how I manage that and how I control that, you know, I think, you know, for me, whilst I talk about, you know, the endurance sport and the ultra running and how that ties into resilience, just as much of that for me is about being out in nature and being out in some pretty incredible environments. I'm really privileged to be based down in central Otago and to be amongst some, you know, really beautiful mountains, really. And for me, a big part of how I manage I guess any sort of tumult that is inside me is to go out into places that make me feel very, very small. Because I think that when you go out into places that make you feel small, when you come back into your own domain, your domicile, your world, you feel a lot more competent, a lot more capable, and a lot bigger than you did before you left. So for me, I don't know, and it's something which I know works for a lot of other people as well, and not necessarily all of us, but for me, a big part of managing that everything that's going on inside is to be out in places which make me feel small, because they also make my problems feel small when I'm there.
You've written a new book, which has really just come out. It's only just been published, called The Comeback Code. Who have you written that for?
So The Comeback Code is for, I mean, it's ostensibly is for young people and teenagers, but I think probably, and as you say, it only came out just over a week ago, the most sort of... not shocking thing for me, but the thing which has probably stood out for me most over the course of the last week, seeing the first reviews and feedback come through, is the fact that consistently people are saying that regardless of their age, regardless of their stage of life, they've found it incredibly helpful. And a lot of people have talked about how beneficial they have found it to be able to put, I guess, some knowledge or understanding or even some research towards things which, I guess that they rely on or have relied on over the course of their life to get through challenge and adversity, and then to expand on that and grow upon that as well. But yeah, it's really, really stood out to me just in the last 9 days that the book has been out to see how the older generation and even people my age, but certainly up from there, have said that it has been impactful and beneficial for them. One of my favourite reviews came out a couple of days ago, and it sort of finishes with something along the lines of, whilst it was written for Generation Z, whilst I am over 3 times the author's age, this book taught me so much, which is, yeah, incredibly humbling. So... yeah, it's for everyone, I would say.
Do we have to go through a life-changing event or face our own mortality to not sweat the small stuff, which so many of us do?
I don't think so. I think that for many people, that is what creates that change. I don't think it's a necessary precursor to creating that change. I mean, for starters... and I guess it's a change which I've seen within my family and people close to me, even over the course of my experience as well. And I suppose that's a bit of a given, since for them that was a massive life-changing experience as well. It was at least as significant for them as it was for me, I think, in terms of my parents and my girlfriend. So do we need to go through that? No, and even for a lot of people, going through that doesn't give them that change either. I think, you know, if we go out into life and face the adversity and challenges that come our way, whether they're big or small, and we do so with the right attitude, then I think you have the capacity to take those lessons and learnings away, irrespective of how big or small that adversity is. I think the attitude and mindset is far more important than anything else.
What's the most amazing thing that you've done in your life?
I got back from Antarctica 3 weeks ago, and, you know, spending time down in Antarctica, I was down there for about 4 weeks with an organisation called the Antarctic Heritage Trust, and that was... yeah, the most incredible experience of my life, I think. I'm not sure if it's sort of recency bias or not. You know, you might have to ask me again in a year or two, but it certainly, I don't think it's just that proximity. I think that actually the further I get away from it, and now I'm finally having a bit of a chance to process that experience, the more incredible it is getting. And, you know, I had the privilege of visiting some of the huts which the Antarctic Heritage Trust maintains there, including Scott's 2 huts and Shackleton's hut as well. The opportunity to be inside basically, you know, the bedrooms of these incredible bastions of resilience, perseverance, dedication and extraordinary endurance taught me, I guess, a lot about resilience through their stories, and the opportunity to be inside their spaces and to see where all of that happened was, yeah, probably the most incredible experience of my life.
Have you seen the Shackleton doco on Netflix?
Yeah, I have, 100%. So
what, that would be one of the all-time most astonishing survival stories in modern history, surely.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, it's And it's funny because it's one of those stories that, you know, at least for me, and I think for most people, you're sort of raised with a peripheral or tangential awareness of it at the very least. You know, it's not like, you know, these names became familiar to me only once I was accepted to go on this trip. These are things which I was, you know, abundantly familiar with, sort of growing up, and stories that maybe my nana told me. And the attitudes, the resilience which these men had was just remarkable. You know, Scott and his team returning from their expedition to the South Pole, where they turned up and found that Amundsen had beaten them to the South Pole by only a matter of weeks. Then turning around, coming back, and all dying on the
not
way,
not making it.
You know,
yeah.
Stories of Lawrence Oates stepping outside of the tent, and his final words being, "I'm going outside, and maybe sometime." You know, sacrificing himself so that his peers could go on without him being a burden to them. You know, it's a level of dedication and resilience, as I say, which is pretty hard to fathom, really. But it was a very, very special opportunity to be immersed with some of the places where these incredible men have walked.
And the best nature docos for me are always set in the poles. There is a mystique about the North Pole, but also Antarctica, that so many of us feel. And I wonder if part of the mystique is we probably will never go. Well, it's one of those places where, in all likelihood, I'll never get the opportunity or the chance to go to Antarctica. Yet you have. So go you.
Yeah, it was a real privilege, and I feel incredibly fortunate. And I very much feel the same way as you did prior, you know, having seen these incredibly remote locations, never having the expectation of going there, and as you say, the mystique that comes from such beautiful, serene environments. And I guess, you know, for any of your listeners that are interested in, I guess, the outdoors and those environments, one of the things which really struck me about it is that prior to going, I had this, you know, very sort of simple and very, I'm not even quite sure how you would describe it. I sort of perceive these places as just being so beautiful, right? So sort of sweet and so amazing, sort of, you know, snowy and white and delicate. And you get there and it is a brutal, desolate, harsh, mean environment. It's ugly in a lot of ways, and in the best way possible. You know, I think that I love being out of the mountains. As I said, my favorite mountains to be in are those ones which are, I guess, beautiful in their ugliness. You know, things like the Remarkables, they're so imposing and harsh and mean. And I think Antarctica has a bit of that kind of, bit of that in it as well, which is what I enjoyed most about the place.
You've led quite a remarkable life, Jake, for someone so young.
Yeah, I think I've been incredibly lucky, as I have said throughout. I try and avoid using that turn of phrase too many times when I do interviews, because it's been remarked on a number of times in subsequent, I guess, articles that I've done with print journalists, that I just can't stop saying it. Like, it's almost it almost comes across in the end as a criticism. But for me, it's no platitude, and it's not just something which I guess draw on in an absence of anything else to say. I really just do genuinely feel so incredibly fortunate, and I have plenty of reason to, right? To be, you know, born in a country where I had access to healthcare, which saved my life, to have been diagnosed when I did, to have been treated by such an incredible medical team, to have been so incredibly fortunate to have survived my cancer and treatment. And then that's before you even get on to the, you know, the public support and care which I received, the opportunities which I've had since the cancer as well. I've just been incredibly lucky. And I think probably the other defining factor of my story has been that there's been amazing people alongside me throughout. And again, that goes back to that medical team that saved my life, to my family and friends, to the general public. I've been incredibly fortunate, and I've been surrounded by some amazing people. And I'm very, very grateful for the life that I've got, yeah.
I reckon if you can acknowledge good fortune in your own life, it's a lovely quality to have. Hey, Jake, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for chatting to us, and all the very best for the brand new book. Hope you go well.
Appreciate it, Ken. That's been a privilege, eh? And very, very grateful to have the opportunity. Wish you all the best.
Take It From Us is produced by Karen Murphy, and I am your host, Kent Johns. Please get in touch with us on Facebook. We'd love to hear from you.
You're listening to Take It From Us. My story, your story, our story.